Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 142 of the Life in Ruins podcast, where we investigate the careers and research of those living life in ruins. I'm your host, Carlton Govert. I'm joined by my co-host, Connor Johnen. David will probably end up joining us. He's taking a little nappy poo at the moment. Probably slept through his alarm clock, as is tradition. And as so tradition. What we decided, we're going to continue on, and he'll just, you know, casually insert himself halfway through the interview, as also is tradition. But we want to apologize for taking a break. I know we started off by saying we're back in business, and then life slapped us in the face with other things going on once again. But we are back to continue on our series on theory in American anthropology.
Yeah, we finished last time talking about Boaz and getting to Boaz and that fun little journey. And we are going to now take the next step and talk about basically the students of Boaz. So moving on from there.
Absolutely. And just a quick recap, Franz Uri Boaz, German-American anthropologist, father of American anthropology.
Papa Boaz,
as known. Yep. So he's kind of the guy. All of our anthropological lineages in some way, shape, or form hit Boaz a couple generations ago. So that's kind of his background, which we talked more on in the last episode. But he sets himself up at Columbia University in 1899, so right at the turn of the 20th century. And he had some pretty significant students who kind of go on to, if Franz is like granddaddy Boaz of anthropology, he creates like four students who like kind of lead each subfield, like that kind of grasp on to this four fields approach, and each one of them kind of takes the mantle for their subfield.
Yeah. So, and Boaz is kind of, and his students continue on in this kind of reaction to the times and really starting to change and radically change the thoughts on anthropology. A lot of these students have strong and unique opinions and theories that kind of come out of this era. So it's a continuation of this Boasian reaction to racism and things like that.
Yes.
Guess who texted?
Guess who texted us? He said he was passed out. Oh, he's coming. He's on his way, ladies and gentlemen. Looks like who we could get ahead, who could get in here before David bumblefucks his way into the episode. So there's four students
that in there at least.
Yeah, there's like four students we want to talk about: Margaret Mead, Edward Sapir, Ruth Benedict, and Alfred Kroeber. Maggie Mead is definitely out of the four, probably the most well known.
Maggie
Mead. So
yeah,
kind of the champion of cultural anthropology.
You could say her and Benedict are the kind of the progenitors of cultural anthropology out of these four.
Yeah. So Margaret and Ruth are kind of they're the cultural anthropologists out of the group, more so. So she did a lot of her field work in Oceania, specifically Samoa. And she was kind of controversial, especially after death, but she was the first president of the American Anthropological Association?
I would not be surprised.
I wouldn't either, but she's in the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Like, she did a bunch of stuff, but her big work here that she contributes to, right? So like Boaz puts forth historical particularism, so that you need to study the culture in the context in which it was created. All cultures are equal. We need to stop this ranking bullshit that other folks are trying to do, but we have to study a culture in its context. She takes that, she being Margaret Mead, and you know, one of her most famous pieces of work is Coming of Age in Samoa. So she did ethnography, lived with Samoans over several field seasons.
And you described her as her personality and her fieldwork is kind of the beginning wave of like feminism, right?
Yeah.
What you say is like, it's a focus on women and their role within cultures more so than we've probably seen in the past.
Absolutely. So she publishes in 1935, Sex and Temperament in Three Primitive Societies. Don't like the word primitive. We've moved past that, hopefully, kind of. Which in this, she's working with a very particular group in Samoa. And in this piece, she claims that females are dominant to the men in this society. There are some issues that she kind of describes, like most Samoans. This is how it is in their culture, and this is the difference between an ethnography and ethnology, where an ethnography is a study of one particular group, and an ethnology is the combination of multiple ethnographies into a study. So she was doing a lot of ethnographic research, doing a lot of ethnography. It's not till after her death, and there's some controversy that goes on, that someone's like, no, and did an ethnology together and compared Margaret's work with other people's work and says, no, she was right. There were some instances where she did go a little bit overboard. But what Connor's talking about is she's working in these with these groups that show that like women aren't naturally inferior to men, that it's a cultural thing. This was a huge shock to American Judeo-Christian women and other people in the West. So like she's bringing out and very similar to at the turn of like that we talked about last episode, the Age of Enlightenment, where folks are going out across the world and finding cultures, coming into contact with cultures that are radically different than their own, bringing them back to their home country. And it kind of stirs things up. And this is what's kind of going on in a repeat cycle where anthropologists are going out, studying these cultures, bringing this information back to this West, exposing the West to this kind of information. And so a lot of her work in the 30s and 40s is kind of the groundwork for the feminist movement that comes in the 60s and 70s. So really awesome work.
Yeah, and she focuses and by highlighting the role of women, the role of development, the role of intimacies between husband and wife, this really changes our kind of our theoretical understanding or at least focus in anthropology. And David came in at the perfect time. But yeah, so her focus definitely on psychological theory and stuff like that is definitely informs and focuses kind of what she's studying. But like Carlton said, and we've mentioned before, this is her work, and the work of all anthropologists probably in the 1900s isn't without controversy. I don't think you could say, I don't think you could say anyone who was doing ethnographic fieldwork in the 1900s was without some sort of asterisk or something going on that not mars, but it is something that's not perfect, I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Margaret, especially like Margaret was controversial in her time for her behavior outside of academia, but today she would be considered just another modern woman. Like she multiple divorces, like enjoyed her time doing what she wanted and wasn't constrained by like American norms of women during the 30s and 20s, but her behavior is completely acceptable today. So she was very much kind of ahead of her time in realizing that the social construct of American culture, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, great work. If you like, highly recommend, like it's foundational for modern cultural anthropology. We've built upon the work of course, but
especially stuff that has any sort of psychological theory or later stuff is definitely built and building off of that.
Yeah. And like the controversies didn't appear till after her death. And so like a lot of this stuff happened in like the 90s is when a lot of these articles were trying to like shame her. But a lot of folks were like, no, you're being a dick, you know, like you're going after her way too hard. Yeah. But she was just one of four. Do we want to talk about Sapir real quick?
Yeah, I think he's an interesting one. We can jump into linguistic anthropology. So Edward Sapir, you've heard his name, but you probably won't recognize it, associated with the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, talking about the relationship between language and culture. He is also a student of Boas. I will look up exactly where he went to school.
It was also at Columbia. So all these students went to Columbia under Boaz and Sapir. So like the difference between linguistic anthropology and linguistics is the study of language, where linguistic anthropology, the study of how language affects culture. So the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which is a joint hypothesis by Edward Sapir and person by the last name of Whorf, and whose name like absolutely eludes me all of a sudden.
Yeah, I don't know.
And so it made a brief appearance, like they name dropped the Whorf Sapir hypothesis.
Benley Whorf.
In Arrival.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like the crux of that movie, is like learning that language and how circular it is allowed her to travel back in time. Yeah, kind of a little ridiculous. But Whorf, linguistic anthropologist, did a lot of work on North American Indian languages, especially in California. He worked with Ishi, which is one of those big living time capsules, I guess is the best way to describe Ishi. We've talked about him before on the podcast. So he's kind of really the father of linguistic anthropology. So a lot of the stuff that he did is foundational for linguistic anthropology today, and really speak and kind of on American Indian languages. And the classification of indigenous languages of the Americas is the big one. So he's the one that really helped guide the language groups and families. Now, they're still being worked on today, but he was really the one to, in order to do that, right? Like there's over 500 recognized tribes in the United States alone, but to be able to cull all that information and with a team to figure out which ones are similar enough and develop language families is a colossal fucking task.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So at least beginning that task and beginning that process is a huge step for linguistic anthropology, at least for our understanding of cultures and languages in North America. So that's where you see your boy Sapir. And we actually defining the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis just is that language affects culture, right?
Yep.
And culture affects language, and there's a relationship between the two.
Yes.
I think that's the basics of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Agreed.
So he did some cool stuff. Do you want to do Kroeber while we're here? Because I know Kroeber worked with...
We can do some Kroeber.
Let's do some Kroeber. So also another cultural anthropologist, Ander Franz at Columbia. All these folks were really talking. These people were born late 1800s, early 1900s, and died midway through the century. You know, this is the kind of time frame that we're talking about here. You know, Kroeber's from Hoboken, New Jersey. And he did a lot of his career at California. So like a lot of these folks like get their degree at Columbia, and they where is Columbia? Chris edited
New York City.
Okay, that's what I thought. So a lot of these folks get trained at Columbia, like in the East Coast, and they end up working in California for some reason or another. But he was also pretty big into archaeology. So even though he's like primarily a cultural anthropologist, he was also an archaeologist and also dabbled in linguistics. Like a lot of those early folks were Fourfield's anthropologists and really trying to use cultural anthropology into these other subfields. He did the Handbook of Indians of California. That was a big one. And his big thing is the development of a culture area. So this is where we get the idea of like Southwest archaeology, Great Plains archaeology, and the subfield. So that was kind of his big his contribution, is recognizing that there are these cultural areas that are bounded by material culture, which is pottery styles, projectile point typology, settlement patterns. So he's the one that was able to kind of identify those relationships. Now, a lot of these things are geographically bounded at times, but there are definitely exceptions to that rule.
Yeah.
So that's kind of really his big idea. So like all the different, you know, we have Southeast Archaeology Conference, Midwest, a lot of that kind of stems from his early work in these culture area approaches.
Yeah, and it's kind of building off the Boasian idea that you need to study cultures in their areas. So the proximity matters, and you have similar cultures that occur in the past and can draw not hard boundaries, but soft boundaries along a lot of these places. So that's something that this culture area concept continues in archaeology and is still used today and is still mentioned today. Although we understand and acknowledge that the boundaries are not real, their constructions, and things are very fluid through time and space. So he sets us on that path, and we still generally call things and describe regions in a way based on the Kroeber culture area. But we have certainly expanded upon and are more complex in how we understand people in the past.
Yeah. And then the last major student is Ruth Benedict. Once again, definitely more firmly rooted in cultural anthropology, but also in folklore.
Yeah, I just saw that. Didn't you write a sweet meme about how folklorists are?
I don't get folklore. Folklore seems cool. Getting to know folklorists, it just looks like lazy anthropology or history. It's like, if you don't want to do the real work, you go to folklore, where it's like, but it's mostly this folklore can be cool, but it's also, I don't know, it kind of comes off as degrading because folklorists work in like European fairy tales, like Cinderella and stuff like that. And then they try to bring that kind of research to American Indian like mythologies. And it's like, stay in your fucking lane and don't equate our shit with Cinderella or Snow White. Like, you don't have the training to do that. Like, you're going to, just you being a folklorist going in and like treating our stuff like folklorist is demeaning. But they also do stuff like out here in Appalachia with like rural communities and like, I don't know, but I also don't know much about folklore. Come at me with your hate. I don't care.
DM Carlton, don't DM the podcast because DM Carlton directly. But yeah,
I thought we were supposed to DM. It's Derek Anderson. All of our hate goes to Derek Anderson.
Derek G.
Derek, no, not T. David. It's the one that Shane kept talking about. It's like
Derek T. Anderson. T stands for Tyrannical Tyler.
Okay.
So Ruth focuses on the relationship between the individual and society and this interplay between them and cultural identity and how beliefs govern culture's behavior. So it's this kind of really complex relationship that she's studying that I don't think anyone's really tried to talk about before, because there is a relationship between the individual and culture and a group culture. So it's pretty revolutionary.
Yeah, great friends with Margaret Mead. They were close. Ruth's big work was Patterns of Culture, in which it's kind of like ascribes culture like an individual. It's kind of a personality is what a culture is. Like, it's a group of individuals' personalities, and it's a consistent pattern of thought. Like, really cool stuff. Definitely delves very much into cultural relativism. Did work in New Guinea with Maggie Mead. Worked primarily in New Mexico, Pacific Northwest. Puebloan kind of stuff. So
she did either go to California or you go to the the Southeast Asia if you're a Carver student. I think that's your two options. Or you're a Boas student. Sorry.
If you've kind of noticed, we haven't hit a biological anthropologist. Well, this time it's been physical anthropology. And that's primarily because even though they're pushing this four fields approach, bioanthropology is still very much
dicey subject at the time.
That and they're mostly like physicians. You actually have to have a medical degree. So it's a lot of doctors and physicians who are practicing because they know the skeleton, like they have the anatomy, and they kind of like do anthropology as a side project. And in America, it's like a lot of cranial morphology. Like, it's a lot of like race science. So the other three fields are like trying to be like cultural relativism. And the bioanthropologists are like, and this is why Black folks need to drink from a water fountain, their nasal cavities too, but just like making shit up.
Yeah.
It's not.
Phenology is the land.
Yeah. It's just like goofy stuff. And it, like my favorite scene of that whole, one of my favorite scenes of Django Unchained is when Mr. Kennedy is like has the skull of one of his former enslaved individuals and shows because the skull is shaped this way, he's an idiot and breaks the skull. And the dude played by, what's his face?
Leo Dio.
No, not Dio. Not Leo.
Samuel Jackson?
No, the bounty hunter.
Oh,
Christoph Waltz.
Yes. When he comes back and is like, you know, Mr. Kent, like, this is the whole idea of the plantation. It's based off of Three Musketeers. He's like, you know, the guy that wrote Three Musketeers, your favorite book, what this whole plantation is based off of. The dude was Black. You're a fucking moron. And then proceeds to shoot him. You know, that's essentially phrenology and cranial morphology and the crux. It's not to say that there's biological consequences of morphology of some things, but culturally doesn't affect much. Like, brain size doesn't affect intelligence.
Yeah, but that was the prevailing thought at the time. Yeah. And these students of Boas are like, yeah, nah, fuck that, and are actively fighting against it. But, you know, we'll say that the bioanth or the physical anth folks, you know, come around. It takes, you know, Nazi Germany to really get them focused and back on to studying humans in a nicer way.
Most of the time. Still do.
And I think in the 30s and before that in Germany, like, a lot of scientists had defected and came to the States or to, you know, England or elsewhere. A lot of Europeans went down to South America. That's a different story. They had like there was some prevailing science overseas that wasn't, you know, the best. And like a lot of them came over here, and Boaz, obviously being a Jewish German himself, came over here and was like, you know, taking calipers and measuring people's skulls wasn't the greatest kind of science. And he kind of saw that. But I think he also did some craniometric stuff too in the beginning, but I don't think it was to drive like race type. So I can't remember if Boaz did or didn't. He has something to do with it.
Yeah, but he came out here in like the late 1800s, like really before the
Third Reich about really when
popped.
A lot of people started coming if they had the money to, I guess is where I'm going with that. But like later on, like Oppenheimer and all those people started leaving, like, you know.
Yeah.
Like when shit was hitting the fan. But point being, a lot of scientists came over here, and Boaz, like in the late 1800s, was one of those, which is why Boaz is coming on like the huge tail end of the Darwinian synthesis as well. Which is why, like, you know, we have this new found way of looking at science, because you have the Enlightenment, and then that kind of pushes towards yada yada, and then Darwin comes around, and we have this pushing towards evolutionism and things in science. And a lot of like the cultural evolutionism at the time was not, that was also a predominant thought among anthropologists, but Boaz being like, well, we shouldn't look at everything this way. And that's where he kind of was profound in saying like cultures don't evolve the same way, though like there is evolution like affecting humanity in many ways.
And it's not unilineal. It's, you know, it's different ways. So yeah. I think on that note, we're going to come back in the second segment and we'll dive into more specifically archaeology in the early 20th century.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies, count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And welcome back to episode 142 of Life Roots Podcast. So we're going to delve into more strictly archaeological theory at this point, because we're archaeologists and that's what our listeners want to hear. So next up, we wanted to talk about V. Gordon Child. The V stands for Vere. Vere, V-E-R-E. Australian archaeologist, comes from an English family, studied really European prehistory. And the reason why he's big is he's an early proponent of the culture historical approach, which was really the first scientific analysis of the archaeological record, trying to find the culture histories of a geographic region. So starting from the top and figuring out all the cultures below and creating a synthesis of what came from before. We now know today, because like early in this, correct me if I'm wrong, they didn't give much leeway for migration or like other forms of change. That basically like the cultures that ended up in the place you investigate are the absolute descendants of the earliest cultures that were there.
That's my assessment of it. Yeah.
Yeah. That comes from the culture area concept, the bounding of it, that they've been there for forever. I mean, but like as to be fair to them, how do you understand movement in the past if you can barely understand what's beneath the ground?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they knew that Rome came from Italy and kind of spread out other places, so they had a general idea.
But North America is like this whole new thing.
Yeah, whole ball game of people that grow corn.
But this culture history thing does come out of Kroeber, does come out of that kind of area. Like it's important to study things and in a more scientific manner as well. And that comes along with seriation, chronology, stratigraphy. All those things are scientific pursuits to understand what has happened in an area in the past.
And it's like we needed that, because like all of these students of the culture historical approach went out and basically did vertical excavations in the earth, figured out all, mostly not all clearly, but they like went in to figure out what cultures and how deep they are in a landscape. And granted, they try to tie them all into each other, but it kind of like set the record for archaeologists later that we'll get into, that Ray will be like, no, 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 this is radically different than what's before. This came from somewhere else. So they kind of set the stage for the compare and contrast, which comes later, that a lot more like archaeological theory and method interpretations built off of, because they went in to basically look for everything in the earth and where it's at. So it's kind of needed. And that's kind of, we've talked about this in several episodes, like a lot of the basic categorizations that are being done both in like cultural evolution, archaeology, and these other things, where there's these broad sweeping categories to try to place people. As we get further in time and as the theory and method further developed, we start seeing the breakdown of those and the reshuffling, but it's all based on these early categorizations that give us the ability to compare and contrast one another as we become like way more systemic in our approaches in archaeology. He also is like definitely one of the earliest known practitioners of experimental archaeology. So he got his experiments to basically test a bunch of stuff and recreate it. So one of the big ones in like in 1937, him and his students used experimental archaeology to investigate the vitrification process that's evident at several Iron Age forts. So he was like actually went to go with his students to go ground test things. So big thing here is the cultural historical approach. Although he wasn't very dogmatic. Like as theories and methods evolved around him, he kind of would incorporate them. So he didn't get like stuck in cultural history. He ends up getting some like Marxist stuff thrown in with his work later in life. Same with the functionalist approaches. So he's able to, like, as archaeology is changing around him, incorporating more of it and changing his views into his work.
Yeah. And like Carlton said, that the important thing is that he is actually wanting to categorize things and catalog things vertically, which is the way I would go if I was going into somewhere I didn't know anything about. You know, you got to establish a chronology. You have to understand how things change through time. So this is, he's building the foundation of the future archaeology by at least using methods that are something we could use in the future.
Yeah. Like we know that the Southeast looks a certain way culturally versus, you know, the Great Basin.
Yeah, so that's kind of building off of Kroeber's cultural areas and putting it in time as well as space. But he was also big on, he's the one that helped divide the Stone Age into Paleolithic, Neolithic, and Mesolithic. So he took the Stone Age, Iron Age, Copper Age, whatever, and then broke Stone Age up even further.
Which was Solon's did bands, kingdoms, tribes. Chiefdoms.
Bands, tribes, chiefdom, states. It was Solon's, yeah.
Which was before or after this?
After.
Okay.
That's like in the 60s.
Right. Answer, what is a chiefdom, please?
Please don't. Definitely. And then he was also big on the urban revolution and the Neolithic. So he really kind of looked at changes in time, like those critical transformations in time. That's another one of his big ones, this idea of the urban revolution. As this is all kind of going around, especially in the early 20th century, we start getting into how the cultural historical process and cultural areas, some archaeologists in certain countries are starting to develop like nationalist archaeology around this time. So like we start seeing Marxist archaeology pretty early on. It's kind of in a lot of archaeological theory today. Might not be explicit, but that's where you get national archaeology. And one of the biggest proponents of national archaeology during this time was Soviet archaeology. So these are like radical Marxists, which is fine, but they start, like in Indiana Jones, how the Nazis are trying to use archaeology to promote German superiority. The Soviet archaeologists were doing the same thing. It's really big today in Southeast Asia, and in particularly China. China is a really good modern day example of nationalist archaeology, where they're always finding the earliest hominid or the earliest evidence of agriculture or the earliest forms of communism. Like it really kind of sucks to try to be an archaeologist outside of China and try to work there, because you have to abide by Maoist doctrine. Like you can't promote or publish things that go against the communist agenda, or else you get blackballed from the country. Or if you promote those things inside the country, you disappear.
Yeah. You also see this in the Middle East when ISIS was happening, was occurring and destroying artifacts of the past because it didn't agree with their ideology. I mean, archaeology and anthropology is weaponized, at least in the modern day and in the past, obviously in Nazi Germany. that was a big thing, is Hitler is collecting a bunch of archaeology and art and stuff like that, and trying to kind of tie the archaeology of the area to his kind of nationalist propaganda and his domination of the world, or his justification for domination of the world.
Yeah, looking for Aryans was basically what he was doing. It was Himmler. Himmler was a huge archaeology freak, and like they funded a shitload of archaeological expeditions. And the issue also with that is, like, in order to be an archaeologist in Nazi Germany, you had to be part of the Nazi Party. Like, no, if
really
about it. Yeah, you had to. Like, there was no, like, it was kind of like very much similar to the Soviet Union. In order to do anything, you had to be a member of the party.
Well, that's why a lot of scientists bailed.
Yeah. Yes, they tried. I mean, they got a lot of funding to go out, especially like Nepal, Tibet. They went to go look for the Aryans. Like, it was.
There's video footage of that stuff too, like them using calipers on people, and they're just like, next. It's just like, what are you doing?
Yeah, doing a lot of phrenology out there.
Yes, their nose is a little bit curved on this side, yeah, but they are not the Aryans.
Yeah.
Like, what are they trying to, like, do?
Because I think everyone knew. Well, I think at that time people knew that there was Aryans at some point in time were from Central Asia.
Like, I think the Caucasus Mountains, is that the
Caucasus? A little bit further east. I'm pretty sure at this point everyone knew about the Indo-Aryan, or that whole idea.
Indo-Aryan expansion.
Indo-Aryan. Yeah. And so they were looking to tie Germany directly to those Aryans that conquered India and then, like, moved west. And like the Sea People of the Mountains that destroyed the Bronze Age for the Mediterranean, the Indo-Aryans were this group that came out of the north and just fuck things up in Central Asia.
Gotcha. Yeah, because like Germans themselves are like very varied people. Like, not all of them are blonde haired and blue eyed. So like, I guess he was just trying to see like what, I can't remember. It was a long time ago we learned about this, but
yeah,
what features he was looking for or whatever. And because I remember the footage, it's definitely in Asia where he's like doing all that caliper stuff.
Yeah. Wasn't great, but there's still a lot of vestiges today. Like, even we still have like white nationalist archaeology here in the States. I don't know if it would consider it archaeology because they're not actually doing it, but you still see like vestiges of this idea, like white nationalism, particularly in the US, like adopts a lot of this shit to try to promote, like Solutrean gets co-opted into this, where they try to point to Dennis Stanford to be like, look, there were white people in the Americas before anyone else, and Native Americans killed them. And so us killing Native Americans is justified because it used to be white people's. And they just like ignored the fact that everyone's like, well, even if Solutreans did do that, they weren't white. Like, they weren't just, they're not the ancestors of modern day Europeans. That was prior to the Indo-Aryan expansion, like very much cherry picking of topics.
Yeah.
It's not great.
When you were in Ukraine, did you see any vestiges of marks or that kind of area archaeology being done?
Yes, I did, Cotter. So one of the vestiges of this nationalist approach, in order to get a PhD in the Soviet system in archaeology, you had to discover a new culture. Like, in order to get a PhD, you had to do something that was like worthy of a PhD. It wasn't just a diss. It's like you had to discover a new culture, and it had to be tied some way, shape, or form. So do you think there's an abundances of cultures in the old Soviet Republic if that was the only way to get your PhD?
Let me guess.
Yet.
The answer is yes. There's a shitload. So like my colleagues that work there now, like Dimitro and others, like they basically have spent their work and now analyzing other people's PhD dissertations to basically be like, no, this is one culture. Because they'd like hyperfixate on the differences of like a pottery style. Like, well, this one has a triangle in it, so it's a completely different culture. So, but it wouldn't be a subgroup or subphase. It's like completely different. So they have an overabundance of what the fuck's going on in their record. So they've kind of had like go back and realize
or synthesize
a lot of it to actually figure out the culture areas that are going on. And it's the work is progressing. But I did see a lot of shovels. I mean, it was we've talked about it on this podcast. There's a lot of kids moving dirt very rapidly.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's because that you have to use that data that was, or you want to use the data that was taken during that time, because if they dug up a site that is important to what you're studying during that time, you would like to use that, but you have to put it into context of what was happening and hopefully give it a different spin or research something differently.
Yeah, And also, like, want to say, like, national archaeology isn't just to, like, the, you know, Soviets. Like, the British were pretty big into nationalist archaeology, too, in a way. Like, they had a really hard time.
Yeah, Piltdown, man.
Piltdown, yeah. Piltdown's an example of, like, someone created a hoax to show, like, the earliest people were in, like, bipedal people or big-brained people were in Britain. Like, massive hoax. But there's also, who was that explorer that traveled the Amazon?
Was that the, not World War Z, what's the other one?
Oh, the City of Z, the Lost City of Z, Zed,
Percy Fawcett. Is that the guy?
I think so.
Is it geography?
Yes, Percy it is. Fawcett. Yeah, Percy Fawcett. Yeah. So he went under the Royal Geographic Society to go discover things in the Amazon. They made an Amazon film about it that features Jax Teller from Sons of Anarchy. I forget his name. And he was able to
find, like, sweating like a faucet in the Amazon.
100%, David. And
I got a clap from Connor.
He found pottery in the Amazon and cultures that were what we'd consider quote unquote complex, more complex than what, like, contemporary Amazonian tribes, brought back to England. It was like, there's evidence of culture here and roads and all this other stuff, and we're just ignoring it. It could even predate English civilization. And they threw a fucking fit about it. British archaeologists were not very happy. They weren't very accepting of data coming outside of the UK that showed complex culture, especially in Africa. Like, Great Zimbabwe is a really good example.
Yeah.
Of that dismissal.
I mean, you still see, I would say in modern archaeology, you still see factions of people in groups.
Oh, like, yeah, the Mormons in Utah. If, like, you want to do archaeology in Utah, if it ain't Mormon, they do not care. That is for damn sure. And I'll go on a record. Like, the Mormon stuff, always protected. But if it's Injun, it's gone. They want to erase it.
Yeah. So there's still a little bit of there. I think there are always going to be a tie to, like, nationalism in the past and, you know, in archaeology. We're trying to get rid of it, but there's always going to be pieces of it, unfortunately.
And we've shown, like, people do that, have done that in the past, right? Like, they'll bury their dead in their house to, like, show they've been there. So, like, archaeology does get co-opted a lot to, like, prove ancestry to a region, a place, or to ideologies. It's just the modern form of, like, burying grandma underneath the floorboards. Be like, no, that's my grandmother. We've always lived here. It's now just like, oh, well, this culture shows why the Crocs sandals people should dominate Florida. I don't fucking know. That's just out of my head, but there's
ways to dominate Florida.
It's Florida. They can have the Crocs.
Fuck away with me. Yeah.
And then, I mean, it cultures do it, or countries do it all the time. You know, Israel, Palestine, and others are always fighting over Jerusalem for nationalist archaeology purposes. It happens.
Yeah.
It's not great, but no. It is what it is.
Now that we pissed off all the world, we're going to end this segment and we'll come back and talk about Daddy Binford. I don't know what we call him. Papa Lou.
Probably Uncle Lou. I don't want him to be my dad, but I'm okay to be, like, related to him. Like, that's like Uncle Lou.
He's our angry uncle.
The angry uncle. Yes. He's the angry drunk uncle. The stories Bob Kelly has about him are just phenomenal.
All right. We'll be right back.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget.
Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Give me something for the pay. Oh, sorry.
Why? Why? Welcome back to episode 142 of Life and Roots podcast featuring Robert Baratheon. No.
Let's just start from the start over.
This is fine. This is
great. No, we need to keep the wine in because me and Carlton did it at the exact same time and it was beautiful.
This is absolutely fine. So to top off today's episode, looking at archaeological theory, we're really going to kind of stop here in the mid 20th century, kind of moving beyond the culture historical approach here. We have a guy that not many people in archaeology know about unless you've taken an archaeological theory course, really, and that's Walter Taylor. He got his PhD in the 40s. Like, they kind of pushed him through because he wanted to go fight Krauts, came back. And his big idea, which he was right, was that the culture historical approach was wrong. However, the way he went about telling people it was wrong wasn't the best. And what I mean by that is that he didn't have proof. His piece called A Study of Archaeology broke down why culture historical approach was wrong and came up with this idea of how we can better analyze the archaeological record, but he didn't have proof or evidence to support it. And he went after a bunch of like top American archaeologists at his time, such as A.V. Kidder, Emil Howery, Frank Roberts Jr., William Webb, William Ritchie, and James B. Griffin. And he like also calls out the Carnegie Institute. So here's this like young upstart who just got back from World War II, probably like not super thrilled to have a bunch of like white collar academics yelling at him after he went and just fought Nazis while he stood at home. So I think there's probably a little bit of that going on. Probably some PTSD, just a tinge, a little to spice things up. So it's not even a published piece. It's a monograph, and he's promoting what's called the conjunctive approach, which combines archaeology with ethnography and social anthropology. So basically it's more like a fusion of archaeology and sociocultural, more so than there already was. Like he kind of recognized like, hey, archaeology is really starting to branch away. We need to bring it back in. He attacks these six prominent archaeologists without providing an example of how the conjunctive approach could work.
So he brought a gun to a gunfight but didn't bring any ammo and starts like shooting at people.
I think he just brought his fists to a gunfight. Like there you go. Like he didn't even bring a gun. He's like, these like, look how smart I am. This is stupid, but like you just have to trust me on it. And it's like, holy shit, dude, like the balls on this dude. But ultimately he got like run out of archaeology. He wasn't able to terminate the culture historical approach. Like he just got shit on by these six prominent archaeologists dominating American archaeology. And like one of the key institutions at Carnegie, that's like, get out. Like we're done with you.
Yes. Yeah, so you yell at the funding mechanisms and you yell at the people who in all sorts of regions, like Frank Roberts isn't he like the kind of Midwest guy? And then you have Kidder who's down in South America. So you're like drawing yourself out of a whole like a continent you're not gonna be able to work in by shitting on all these people.
He's like attacking the standard bearers for all these different cultural areas. Like he's hitting the top guy in every region. Like you're an idiot, and they just run him out of the field because like they're the ones with all the students. Like Taylor doesn't have any students. He's not tenured anywhere.
Yeah,
and it's a monograph. Like it's not even a published book. It's like a pre-book. You know,
Reviewed or anything.
But like even though he gets run out, his idea of the conjunctive approach kind of starts getting adopted by other folks. So like there's this big debate in the 50s called the Ford-Spalding debate, which was a series of articles between James Ford and Albert Spalding over theoretical differences towards the approach of scientific inquiry in archaeology. Ford believed that artifact types were constructions that were imposed by archaeologists and not necessarily representative of the creators, right? So like modern day people applying their own beliefs as to what cultures in the past were doing with these materials, which he's right, turns out. It's like, yeah, our idea of what a cup looks like might not be the same idea that someone's idea of a cup was in the past. But Spalding was way more like quantitative methods based in archaeology and believed archaeologists should try and reveal the emic approaches of objects. like, so they're both trying to get at the same thing through different methods. So like Ford is trying to be like, well, we need to do way more ethnography, where Spalding's like, well, math will do it for us. And it's like, they're just tacking past each other to do the same thing. And so Ford was the one really using this as an extension of the conjunctive. Both of them were actually kind of applying the conjunctive approach, actually. They both kind of co-opted what Taylor was doing. It's like, yeah, culture historical is probably wrong, and use the baselines for Taylor's monograph to like argue in articles with these two guys. Because like the conjunctive approach called for collaboration between social anthropology and archaeological methods. So it's like taking the qualitative data gained from sociocultural and merging it with the quantitative data from archaeology, rather than archaeologists trying to come up with the qualitative on their own and bring in their own biases outside of these worldviews that produce these cultures. The Ford-Spalding debate, though, ended in the 1960s, really with new archaeology.
Yeah. What you could say is built off of Stewart and kind of Julian Stewart's fieldwork and his adaptation stuff.
Yeah.
So it's kind of coming out of there that humans are adapting to their environment, using these quantitative and qualitative approaches, and ultimately trying to numbers everything is what at least starts out as, it feels like.
Yeah. And like Taylor is alive during this time, and he is, and like Lou Binford is really the standard bearer of new archaeology or processual archaeology. And like Taylor is like in the '60s, like writing is like, well, wait a minute. Well, I started this. Like Lou Binford is doing what I did. And it's like, shut up. You didn't prove it. Like, yeah, you threw this idea out before you proved it. And your idea got utilized. People recognized it and they were able to prove it on their own. And they wrote articles about it. Like you didn't do much with this, man. Because like Lou Binford was also like, you got to use ethnography. And yeah, this whole idea of new archaeology was like very quantitative focused. It's like, archaeology is going to be a science with capital S. We're going to use the metric system. Everything's in meters now. Welcome to it. We're going to make squares. We're going to use grid paper, rulers for everybody. And
kilocalories.
Kilocalories. Like we're gonna turn this shit into a science. And but based on ethnography, right? Binford, I wish I could have met the guy, because if you listen, go back and listen to Bob Kelly's episode, because Bob Kelly talks about a Thanksgiving he spent with Binford, and it ends with a broken window in New Mexico. It's a great little window into the past.
Yeah, we should also mention David Clark in this sort of. Like he's the European Lou, essentially, isn't he? Mm-hmm. The Cambridge. Yeah. So he promotes the processual archaeology in Cambridge and is kind of given they're both the bulldogs of processual archaeology is what I call them. I wouldn't call him the founding fathers. They're the bulldogs. They're the ones who bully us into fucking doing science based archaeology.
Yeah. I think bully is a really good word.
Yeah,
they're big, big personalities and they get things done. They have it their way.
Can we define processual archaeology for the audience? It's pretty.
Yeah, go for it, David.
Like, I'm asking if you guys could pretend on the audience who doesn't know what it is.
Why don't you pretend I'm the audience that doesn't know what it is?
Well, processual archaeology, like, I don't know the exact definition, but it's looking at like archaeology scientifically, like doing things like from a very data driven standpoint.
Yes.
I don't know if there's like a full textbook definition of it, but
there's usually adaptation thrown into that too. Adaptation is kind of the key.
Yeah. So the big one is processual archaeology argues that ideas and theories mean nothing without any ability to prove them. This is the scientific approach, right? So it applied the scientific method to archaeology, emphasizing the need for objectivity when looking at the material record. And this is my personal gripe with processual archaeology, because like they came up with the idea that an archaeologist can relieve themselves of all bias and study the archaeological record. Like you can go into these things and train people to come in with a clean slate. Like you show up to an archaeological dig and you just like empty all your knowledge of culture and how you use things and be able to study and identify what things were of the past. So like,
well, when were they pushing this? What, the 50s, 60s?
60s and 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. So like we weren't, you know, we weren't exactly where we are today with society. Yeah. So it's a lot of objectivity is missing.
It was like one of those, like if you listen to the Joe Watkins episode, when he talks about like when he was getting into archaeology in undergrad, like archaeologists told him because he was native, he couldn't do archaeology because he couldn't be unbiased towards the archaeological record. Like, he came in knowing too much, and therefore he couldn't be able to do archaeology because he was going to be too biased. And it was like, wait the fuck a minute. Like, that's completely ridiculous. That, and we talked about it in that episode, so I won't talk about it here. But it was just like one of those funny ideas that people thought early on that you could just empty yourself of all biases.
And what Carlton's kind of hinting at is because, so you have processual archaeology pop onto the scene, Lou Binford's a dick and just like yells at people. He can't write for shit. He writes like huge monographs with a bunch of numbers and stuff like that. And then you have this very, very prominent critique of this idea, you know, coming off of the idea that archaeologists aren't biased and things like that. So you have a big reaction to processual archaeology, kind of arguing that humans aren't specifically numbers and they want to bring archaeology closer to anthropology because you can see it kind of veering away from it as the processual archaeology comes in. There is this backlash to things. I think it's after Lou dies, to be honest.
Yeah. So like processualism has its merits. Like it really did move us towards science, like which I believe correct. Like we need to standardize these. We have to hypothesize tests. Like we can't just make claims about the past without testing them. So it very much is needed. And it standardized a lot of practices and methods. And that's where we, you know, people criticize methods. Like, well, can you repeat this experiment? How do you know this? But that idea that Connor said of like, you can't be unbiased in the archaeological record created this, there was like a critique of it. So before we have like a whole new theoretical paradigm, and this is where I think personally what happens after new archaeology or processual archaeology, it's not really a new paradigm, but just a critique and realignment of processual archaeology. But I know other people would argue against that, but that's in my head how I see it, because it's like, wait a minute, what's called post-processualism, where postmodernism seeps into archaeology, is really a critique of like, wait a minute, we are biased and we have to acknowledge that, but that doesn't mean it's to our disadvantage, that some of our backgrounds can actually help us better understand the archaeology. So an indigenous person might be able to better identify what some of these tools are for, or people that are local to the area, not necessarily indigenous. I'm like, there's a really good case study of archaeologists in the Alps who found, it looks like a dodecahedron, a many-shaped giant dice looking thing. D20. Maybe, I think it might have been like a D15 or D12. It's something. And they like showed it to locals, so they didn't know what it is. And then like a local grandmother saw it and laughed and like came back. She had one, and it's used to knit mittens. And so this woman living in the Alps who makes mittens was able to recognize something from an archaeologist from like Rome who's not accustomed to making mittens, couldn't identify, right? So it's not just you have to be Samoan to understand Samoan culture, but like interacting with locals is a big part of it.
I think you're correct, because that's probably where you exist, and theoretically, right? Is you're kind of in the you're post-processualist because you, but you have scientific methods. But there are people in archaeology who are going more postmodern, and they are going down that rabbit hole, which is, you know, to each their own. It's not how I would approach the past, but there are people, and that post-processual critique starts that kind of jump into the postmodern approaches to things.
It's like when I went to the Flint Epic Festival, like I learned so much more about lithics and like ancient stone tool like manufacture from like working with live people flint napping from all different perspectives of it, that like I was like, oh, so that's what that would be for. And like more than I've ever learned from an archaeologist, which is, I mean, in terms of like understanding lithics at a site and stuff, I'm going to learn that from an archaeologist, but like, how are they doing this? How are they doing that? How the flakes form and things like that. I learned that from flint napping. So that's a pretty post-processual way of looking at stuff. Like,
And so post-processual archaeology is sometimes called interpretive archaeologies. And this is what kind of drives me up the wall. You have like post-processual, you have processual, which is new archaeology science-based. And then they attribute like indigenous archaeology, gender archaeology, like all these other different archaeologies to post-processual. And like kind of going back, like I don't think post-processual archaeology is necessarily its own theory. I really just think it's just a readjustment of processual. I'm like, no, there are women in the past. No, there are other people in the past. We just got to remember that and do that. Because it's not like women didn't exist before in the archaeological record before processual archaeology. if that makes sense. It's like, so that's where I come from of like,
So they like pigeonhole you. Like if you say you're an indigenous archaeologist, people start like rolling their eyes like, oh, he's doing some sort of like postmodern approach, but you still use science and data in your research.
And most archaeologists, like people that are like ascribe post-processual. Now I do think there are adherents, or I do know that there are people that would like, well, I'm a post-processual archaeologist. They want to distance themselves. I'm like, the only difference is like processual archaeology is the use of data. You're still using data. So like, I don't see it as a paradigm shift. I think it's, I call it the post-processual critique. Like, wait a second. We got to remember we're dealing with people. Like people aren't numbers. We got to bring the anthropology back and remember that. So I just see it as one giant theory that we've been doing since the 60s and just kind of, that's how I see it. And like, I'm probably a minority in that because I'm also one of those folks. I don't ascribe myself to a particular theory. Like I know some of my colleagues are like, I'm a Marxist. I do Marxist archaeology. That's how I see the world. People are energy. Fuck the capitalists. And I'm like, no, I just use what I need to understand the archaeological record that I'm digging.
Like, you know, but there's more than like, you don't have to subscribe to just one. I think that's something that we all get bogged down with in school. Like I have several grad students that message me on Instagram that are like, I don't know like which one to pick. And I'm like, you don't have to pick one. Like, I'm probably super postmodernist in what I do, but like degree wise, I'm extremely processualist. Like I can't.
We came from very like Wyoming and you came from Tennessee, which is like also like David comes from very hard processual. Very processual schools. Like Wyoming is a very processual school. Like, but they still do data and work with living people. Like shit, Todd Servell works with the Doha. Bob did all this stuff. Like they still did kind of what this post-processual critique was like calling for more people to do, but it's really this bogged down, like people get really way too like revolved, like stuck in this idea, well, processual archaeologists do science and post-processualists do interpretation, and it's like you guys are all doing the same fucking thing.
Yeah,
and I want to mention that like what you're studying matters too. So like if you want to take Marxist approaches to something, you're probably talking about larger scale societies. And I've said this on the show before. So there, it's okay to change your approach and your theoretical understanding of things based on what you're studying. I see zero problem with that.
Absolutely. Exactly. And a solid example of that too is like if you're doing historical archaeology on someone's mansion from 1750, you can very easily do Marxist archaeology. Be like, wow, this person had slaves, like he had a plantation. Well, I wonder what the power dynamics were here. But if you want to look at stone tools on an archaic site in the Great Basin, like really all you can go with is behavioral ecology. Be like, okay, well, he wanted to eat this many calories and fuck. So like, like well, what else do you have?
And stone tools don't come in pink and blue. Like you can't figure, like there's no, you can't really do gender archaeology. Like a lot of that stuff to do interpretive archaeology when you're just working off of stone tools is fucking impossible. And it just becomes like way more not necessarily evidence-based. Like you can do, and that's, you know, that's where Wyoming succeeds really well. It's like they do Paleonid archaeology. There's only so much theory you need to count rocks and bones, talk about divisions of labor, but you can't necessarily talk about
a body. Well, this pile of debitage had a better view of the river than this one, so we can tell that this person was definitely a man.
Yeah, can't do that, you know.
You can. So
a lot of it's just left to, I mean, that's it. Depends on the archaeological record you're working in, depends on the place.
There's also like the feminist archaeology, and then there's queer archaeology is like a big thing too, which I've been seeing recently as well. And people are like, well, we should talk more about this, and well, we can. But again, all we have is rocks. So like, what do we not, like? Yeah,
it's not that we don't want to study it. It's that it's hard to do good science and study it in hunter-gatherer populations, paleo.
Right, but if you're looking at like a plantation or something like that, you can definitely do that. Like, something more recent. Yeah,
we can't figure out who was
sexuality or anything like that. Yeah,
we can't. I still hold that Lewis and Clark were gay.
That's fine. But in the archaeological record, I don't know what to say to that. Probably, maybe, you know, it's like there's only so much you can do in certain archaeological contexts, depending on the record that you have. So most of us work, we all work in an archaeological record over 500 years ago. You two work further in time than I do. But even still, there's only so much I can figure out based on earth lodges and corn. Like I don't, you know, I don't deal in historic archaeology where you can figure out more of these you know, quote unquote post-processual archaeologies that can be applied. If anyone knows of someone that does queer archaeology,
yeah, hit us up.
Research, please let us know, because I know nothing about it.
Yeah, we should actually get that on the show, because I would love to know more about it, like examples and stuff. Yeah.
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 Well, we just outed ourselves as straight man archaeologists.
Thanks for listening to us. We kind of went all along, but I'm going to recommend two books for y'all to understand anthropology theory and archaeology theory. One of them is Visions of Culture, an introduction to anthropological theories and theorists by Jerry D. Moore. He's awesome. He really puts stuff in bite-sized pieces and is easy to devour. Don't read Bordeaux.
Don't
translations they suck. Read Jerry D. Moore. Another book is Archaeological Theory and Practice by Patricia Urban and Edward Shortman. That's what we use at our archaeology class to study the history of that. So once again, that's bite size. Those are very easy to consume if you're interested in studying this further.
Yeah, and I'll throw up as well the theory books I got at Boulder and also the ones we used at Indiana. I don't know the ones at Indiana, but like there's a lot of different theory books. Some are better than others. And then honestly, Archaeology 7th Edition by Bob Kelly and DHT is not a bad intro to archaeology book. It has all the theories. It's like a children's high school like textbook. Like it has it's pretty good. Like for freshmen, like it is an excellent, like, here are the vocab words, here are the questions you should think about, here are the great pictures.
And if you want to do Mormon archaeology, might I suggest the Book of Mormon? And if you would like to do behavioral ecology, may I suggest The Origin of Species and The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, I guess.
Yep. So we'll throw all those out.
Yep. Like, reuse, subscribe, send us emails, all that shit. Send it to us. We love you.
We're getting your emails. We will respond to them. Thank you all so much for giving us feedback. It's been very critical, constructively. They're nice emails to read. And God bless you. We love everything you send us. We really appreciate it. And if you're listening on the All Show feed, please stop, listen, subscribe, and download our show. I can see the numbers, everybody. I have access. I have the power. We still got followers in Kazakhstan. We want to boost those numbers, though. So let us, you know, tell your Kazakh friends about us. And with that, we are
number one podcast in all Kazakhstan.
we're getting canceled. All right.
Thanks for listening to A Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at A Life in Ruins podcast. And you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer.
All right, everybody. So now it is time. Connor, what joke do you have for us this evening?
So I just found out the CEO of IKEA is the new president of Sweden. He's still assembling his cabinet.
You didn't even give us time to think on that one. Yeah. I guess it wasn't really the question. It was just a statement.
Yeah, that was good. I like that one. That was good.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.